thing factors is to look at these are dollars.
Good afternoon, everyone.
We're right here.
So we're going to start committee now. I can wait. Good morning, members. I bring the Education Finance Committee for March 26th to order, and the first item on the agenda is approving the minutes for March 24th. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have. I'll move them.
Thank you. Chair Kreisha has seen the minutes for March 24th. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed say no. The minutes for March 24th are adopted. With that, members, our first item on the agenda is one we have seen in the past few years. This is something that is what we move to adjust. I'll start over again. Members, I'm just going to move House File 4213 before the committee with a motion to move it to Ways and Means. It contains the K-12 forecast adjustments. These forecast adjustments align with the February 26th forecast data that funds each of our K-12 programs and appropriations according to the underlying statutory formula. As the bill summary from our nonpartisan staff states, the change in the appropriations both up and down are real and the changes must be enacted into law. Members, does anyone have any questions regarding the forecast adjustments in House File 4213 for nonpartisan staff?
Okay.
Representative Bakeford.
I don't have questions for nonpartisan staff, and more of just a discussion point for the group to be aware of. Mm-hmm. So is that where you'd like to do this now?
Sure.
Okay. So thank you, Chair Joachim and Co-Chair Kreisha for bringing this adjustment. I want to just point out to the committee on page 8 of the bill, lines 8.5 to 8.8. And that's where you'll see the increase in special education funding. It's about a $70 million increase and then about a $153 million increase in 2027. For that biennium, it'd be about $220 million more than was originally budgeted. To put that into simple terms, and I think we've heard this pretty extensively, the cost of special education services continue to go up, which is, you know, why we're having this conversation. But what we don't see in this forecast adjustment is what's going to happen in 28 and 29. So just to remind the committee that beginning in 2028, the special ed spending will be cut by $125 million a year. That was in the Blue Ribbon Commission, so a total of $250 million. These are ongoing, and these are real cuts to funding being provided to our local school districts that are providing the special education services that they're mandated by federal law and IDEA to do, which I would love. We can have a conversation about the feds and upholding their side of it. That is both sides of the aisle, to be very blunt, going back all the way to IDEA. So that's not a partisan conversation, that's just a reality. But these are real cuts that are going to impact real kids, and it will have a general education cost. And this is where we talked about with the Blue Ribbon Commission, one of the things being talked about is ADCESS funds, one of the proposals. That would be devastating, not only to our schools, but also to special education, because those are pre-referral special education services. So the centerpiece of the governor's supplemental education plan was an additional $25 million per year, bringing that cut to $300 million for the Blue Ribbon Commission to come up with for schools. And we understand where we're at from a fiscal standpoint. The piece that should enrage every single member of the committee is that the governor is making this proposal while also proposing to increase funding to the Department of Education. That is an insult to our schools. So I would agree that if the governor only wants to cut funding to schools, maybe we just take a break, sine die, so that we can get real, honest negotiations to go. I'm here to debate, I'm here to discuss and actually solve problems, but shifting more costs to our schools while not getting serious about addressing the increases that happened last year to our state agencies is completely unacceptable. So obviously support this bill, Madam Chair. Moving forward, we have to do this, but we also have to be equally as honest about the decisions that are being made and are being pushed onto our local schools.
Representative Bakeberg, I think all of us on both sides of the aisle agree with you on the outrage that $50 million more would be cut. With that $50 million more would be asked of the Blue Ribbon Commission to find in cuts. And just a quick clarification, and I don't agree with this either, but the Blue Ribbon Commission, where that money would come from would be the special education cross subsidy. Now, that was one of the keystones and what we're very proud of when we passed the 23-24 budget. We had that cross subsidy at 44% with it growing up to 50%. I remember some angsty discussions around that because folks were upset about covering the federal portion of that funds, but we got it passed. In 2019, it was our former chair, Jim Dabney, I believe, in 2019, that first started paying for the cross subsidy at either 7 or 9%. So I'm glad we got it where it was, but we all share the angst that the governor thinks we can find even more savings in special ed than what the Blue Ribbon Task Force was already tasked to do. So with that, Chair Kreshaw.
Thank you. And my questions, and thank you, community members. My questions are for nonpartisan staff, specifically Mr. Strom. So the first one is, Mr. Strom, is you've been doing this a long time. You know, some of us won't be in education finance, and if I had my way, we'd have been done yesterday. But which, by the way, I didn't tell anybody I was doing that. So, but Mr. Strom, as you look at the forecast articles and looking ahead, you've looked at these numbers, and if Ms. Beckel wants to jump in as well, are there any trends in here? You know, I've looked at them, I've looked through them, but is there anything in there that raises an eyebrow with you and trends that other members you should just point out and say, hey, here's something we should watch. Here's something that's a little bit disturbing. We've already identified the special ed, but I'm just looking for your years of experience and, you know, what kind of has got the hair in the back of your neck standing up if there's anything.
Mr. Strom, I don't know if you want to be put on the spot. Go ahead.
Chairs, you, Akeem, and Kreshaw. I'd make a couple of comments. The adjustments happen with the forecast twice a year, and oftentimes a group of years, two or three years, may sure seem like a trend. From a statistical basis, that may not really be the case, but the getting something wrong four or six times the same direction in a row often seems to provoke a fair amount of conversation. And certainly with the issue of the special education appropriation, this is a continuation for several years. Again, I don't think statistically one could say anything given the small number of cases, but it's five or six forecast cycles now where each forecast has adjusted that up. So it's certainly something to keep in mind when thinking about why the costs in special education, because the formula is cost-based, why the costs are growing faster than MDE and the others are identifying each year. And on the other hand, you can see if you look at the meals appropriations that we've had several years in a row with those going up, and now those are a little under. So on the one side, I'd say it looks like for meals, for example, that there's a better handle now on projecting those into the future. For special education, it's somewhat concerning to me that the air goes the same direction. On the other hand, overstating it, having legislative action to fix something and then having a number come in lower is probably what we'd refer to as a type two error and a much worse kind of error to make from a policy point of view. But I would certainly, as legislators, I would certainly encourage you to keep a very close eye on the special education number and see where we are again in November of 26 on the forecast amounts for those.
Thank you, Mr. Strong.
And just one
Chair
more. Thank you. And then can you remind us which of these items need to be adjusted versus which are standing and open?
Mr. Strong.
Chairs Kreshaw and you, Akeem. In the K-12 world, the general fiscal world in which we lived for many years was very opposed to open and standing appropriations. So for a long time, only general education was an open and standing appropriation. A few years ago, the debt service equalization appropriation was added to the list of open and standing appropriations. There's some history with that particular program when the debt service equalization was passed in 1991. The governor at the time vetoed it in part because it had an open and standing appropriation. I'm not sure that the reason not to have gone one sooner with debt service equalization aid was based on that. I think more just a general feeling that K-12 should not be subject to open and standing appropriations. This is different than some other budget areas. For example, in the taxes world, for the portions of K-12 aid that come through tax credits, those are generally open and standing. So there's a number that are open and standing in the Chapter 270s. But for the K-12 ones, just those two, debt service equalization and general education, are open and standing.
And Chair Strom, Chair Kreisha.
Should be Chair Strom. Thank you, Mr. Strom, and I recommend a yes vote on that.
Thank you, Chair Kreisha. And with that, members, I thank you for your cooperation on this. And the motion will be renewed that House File 4213 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted, and House File 4213 is on its way to Ways and Means. With that, members, I am going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Clardy and go present my bill up at the dais.
So our next agenda item is House File 4198. Chair Joachim, would you like to move House File 4198 before the committee with the intention to hold the bill over for possible inclusion for the Ed Finance Bill?
Yes, Chair Clardy, that would be my motion.
You may present your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move before you is House File 4198. Over the last few years, we've been moving towards treating grants in our committee a bit differently. We've tried to move away from the legislatively appointed grants and towards competitive grants. As we continue in that direction, I would like to start the discussion on the types of grants we should consider. We've heard a great deal this session from students, administrators, and support staff about the need for more mental health supports in our schools. And while we created a funding stream for our student support staff when we set the 23-24 budget, there's still more that we need to do. I also believe that there's a role for our community partners that they can play in supporting student mental health when students are not in our school buildings. This bill is the start of what a framework for a competitive grant to organizations from the Minnesota Department of Education may look like to improve student mental health and programming after school and during the summer months. I could also see this expanding to community organizations that support our students during school hours as well, and maybe even having another grant bucket that focuses on academic supports. But the bill before you, I think we can agree mental health among our students is important, and that we could also probably agree that cell phones and other devices have created a barrier among young people and many adults. In the most recent student survey of 11th graders, 44% reported spending too much time on social media. Studies have shown that spending extensive amount of time on social media pulls our students away from making connections with their peers and can lead to poor mental health. But I have good news. Groups like the one you'll hear from shortly are doing something to intervene in that cycle and are seeing improvements in mental health among the students who attend their camp, and they have collected data to show just that. We will hear from Campfire Minnesota, which is in Representative Reams District and serves students from all around the metro area. And with that, I will turn my testimony over to the testifier.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. I think we have a testifier, Aida Mahita. Can you help me with your name?
Aida,
so please state your name.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Aida Mahita. I am the Senior Development Manager at Campfire Minnesota, as well as the parent of a 6-year-old current camper. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4198. Thank you, Representative Joachim, for authoring the bill. My statement today is about the positive role nature can play in supporting youth mental health. For young people today, rates of anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation continue to skyrocket without a clear solution in sight. These challenges are largely driven by negative impacts of social media, feelings of loneliness, and increased violence. The collective social and emotional development of our young people is suffering following extreme isolation caused by the pandemic, excessive phone usage, and limited in-person interactions, reducing the development of emotional intelligence and social skills. Studies show that time away from phones and outside in nature both significantly improve the mental health of young people. Time in nature almost instantly lowers cortisol levels, heart rate, and blood pressure, reducing anxiety and regulating one's emotions. Delivering nature-based programs to over 11,000 youth annually, Campfire Minnesota's 103-acre property in Excelsior offers a nearby escape into nature for youth from across 33 counties. At camp, we hold a strict no-screens policy, allowing campers to fully disconnect and be present with their peers. Through activities like hiking, rock climbing, snowshoeing, ice fishing, and archery, we help young people build courage, leadership, social skills, and peer connection. Through activities like fort building, canoeing, and sports, our campers expand their communication skills, learn how to solve problems, work as part of a team, and most importantly, how to adapt when things don't go as planned. These are core life skills that build confidence, resilience, belonging, and as a result, significantly improve youth mental health. All young people deserve the opportunity to ignite wonder, play in the dirt, climb trees, and swim in a lake. But not all families can pay for these programs, making scholarship support critical in creating access. Over 50% of the youth we serve at Campfire rely on scholarship support. Expanding access to nature programs is an investment in the mental health and wellness of young Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. We have another testifier, Alexa Flipsack. Could you please state your name and affiliation?
Hello, my name is Alexa Flipsack, and I'm a youth board member at Campfire Minnesota. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Alexa Flipsack, and I'm a youth board member at Campfire Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4198. Thank you, Representative Joachim, for authoring the bill. I support this bill because I have seen firsthand the impact of spaces where young people can disconnect from technology while embracing nature, form relationships, and connect with themselves. My connection to Campfire started far before my role as a youth board member. I began as a camper in 2014, where I experienced the magic of camp for the first time. I grew up during a major rise in technology, from having limited access as a child to a world in which a smartphone is as normal as the clothes we wear, particularly among youth. I attended camp every summer, thanks to Campfire's scholarship fund, and every time I came home with new friendships, new interests, as well as songs, as well as an acquired taste for singing camp songs. But one thing that always stuck with me was the feeling that camp gave to me, to be disconnected from everything online while connecting with everything face to face. One thing I will never take for granted, especially after the isolating days of COVID-19. It is empirical for the development of youth to be outside, immersed in nature, trying new things. Now, as a counselor, I witnessed the same impact on kids today. One camper shared, quote, "I've struggled with my mental health for a very long time, and being outside, surrounded by nature at Campfire, I've been the happiest I've felt in years. The environment at Campfire is absolutely amazing. Everyone is so kind, from the campers to the counselors and all of the staff. You're encouraged, but not forced to do things out of your comfort zone, which I was quite afraid would be the case. I am forever grateful for everything Campfire has done for me and how it helped me become a happier, more social, and better person," end quote. That's what these spaces do. They give youth of all backgrounds a chance to feel like their real, truest selves without the anxieties of social media. Campfire shaped my curiosity and leadership. It's why I came back to work there and serve on its board. And it's why I believe every child should have access to experiences like this. For these reasons and more, I stand here in support of House File 4198. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexa. It looks like we have one more testifier, John Fanning.
Hello, Chair and members of the committee. I'm John Fanning, Director of Education Partnerships Coalition, and you've learned a little bit about the coalition the last few times I've been here. What I'll add today is that while our communities, our nine communities, all share a framework, the work is always community-led and locally decided. And so, for example, we work with local youth to support them in articulating an advocacy and action plan for their community. What do EPC youth want to talk about? You guessed it, youth mental health. They speak from lived experience and they collect and analyze data through a rigorous process. For example, in one EPC community, 75% of youth feel anxious or nervous. 66% struggle with controlling worry. 61% lose interest in activities they used to enjoy. 55% feel depressed and homeless. And 31% have seriously considered suicide. We older folks, I'm an older folk, may find these numbers really hard to understand, but I was a public high school counselor when smartphones first came on the scene. None of this surprises me. Two headlines from yesterday can help us understand these dynamics. Headline number one. Parents seeking tighter restrictions on social media have welcomed an unprecedented win. Jurors found that Meta, which owns Instagram, Facebook, and WhatsApp, and Google, owner of YouTube, intentionally built addictive social media platforms that harmed the young plaintiff's mental health. Headline number two, two teenage boys who used artificial intelligence to create fake nude photos of nearly 60 of their classmates, female classmates, were put on probation last Wednesday after dozens of victims testified. These young women described the fallout, anxiety attacks, a loss of trust, problems focusing on school work, and a fear that these images would someday surface in unexpected ways, as well as, quote, how excruciating it is to bring these feelings up again and again and again. Even without including the negative impacts of COVID and Operation Metro Surge on youth mental health, which are significant, we are in a deep crisis. The world that has emerged around our young people over the past 20 years is nothing short of terrifying. Our young people need support, and they need tools to protect and improve their mental health. This bill is a step in the right direction. We're deeply grateful to be able to talk with you about it today, and we strongly encourage your support of House File 4198. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will now move to member questions. Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Joachim, for bringing this bill. I really appreciate this work. I just had a group of students that was in my office talking about youth mental health, and I was talking to them about our work with the student support personnel and trying to increase that funding. And, you know, one of the things that they said to me was, yes, therapy is great, but we also want to be healing in community, right? It's not just about maybe working in a room with an individual therapist, but it's about how do we build stronger bonds, stronger relationships, which I think can really contribute positively to youth mental health. So I really like this approach. And then the other thing I like is just the emphasis on disconnecting from electronics and social media. I know for me, as a parent, like social media and devices is one of the things that I feel most scared about my kid growing older. You know, I had a bill that I presented in education policy around, you know, banning screen time for our youngest learners, because I just think that we are really seeing the benefits of screen time and devices really do not outweigh the consequences. So I really like the emphasis for that. I know that I really want to see our kids get outside more, be on screens less. And I think this is a really good approach. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Dippel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Joachim, for bringing this. I also agree that the screen time issue is a big issue. The social media issue is a huge issue, both in schools and outside of schools. I think our youth
unfortunately is half or more being raised by devices, and it has been absolutely detrimental to their mental health and other parts of their development. And so with the organization, for instance, who just testified up here from the Campfire Minnesota, other organizations exist too that seek to get these kids out into God's creation to see and enjoy the beauty that is around them, which is intricate and truly amazing, far more amazing than generally what is found on the screen of a device. And so I'm thankful for those organizations also. And beyond that, we were just talking here. There are small things that can be done. We were talking and kind of joking, but not really. As I walk from the COB building, maybe you've seen me cut through the grass from time to time and beeline it up to the Capitol. And I just enjoy walking on grass more than concrete. I think children do too. I am the board chair of a school. We try to get our kids outside as much as we can. In education policy, we heard from a principal recently who is trying to be creative about getting their students out and doing things, even interacting with and raising chickens and goats and other animals and things like that. That's been extremely helpful too. I can speak from experience living out in the country. I live on the end of an island, and we have a lot of different animals out there, and we enjoy that. So those things are very, very important for students, children, and their development. Now, one item, however, that I would just like to ask either Chair Joachim or any of the testifiers, if they're up to speed on the SGO credit funding, that we can get a tax credit of $1,700 per individual in Minnesota if the governor would opt into that program or if the legislature would force that. That would be $1,700 per taxpaying individual can donate that to a school organization that is a public charity. At least 90% of the funds are used for educational purposes, and there's a multitude of students across different schools that utilize that. This sounds like one of those programs, and if not, it likely could be modified to fit within that. And we've talked a lot about different programs, different needs. We talked about cuts that are going to occur to special needs students, which certainly we don't want to cut funding to the most needy in our state. I think we've agreed on that also. But we need to be creative, and I've likewise heard arguments that made it sound like this is some kind of Trojan horse piece of legislation and it's only for private schools, when 90% of the students in Minnesota are public school students. 90% of this funding would go to public schools who need that funding. I can understand the perspective if you're trying to protect a small group of interests. You know, if you want to do that, that's one prerogative. You certainly can do that if that's what you want to represent. But we truly are talking about children's hearts, minds, and souls and their mental health. And it's unfortunate that when there is a significant amount of money on the table to truly help public school and non-public school students, yes, non-public school students, 10% of Minnesota students, 90% of the students in Minnesota are public school students. And I just met with a constituent before coming up here for education finance, and she said mental health is such a big issue in public schools right now, and we need more money for this. It's a detriment to our students that we don't have counselors that can even stay on board when you have some knife-wielding person at a public school and the students are wondering if they can even come to school again. That's a story that happened in my district recently and that this individual from NAMI just told me about, and that I said, I would advocate on your behalf for the sake of these students, for the health of these students. So I may have saved up a lot of my commentary over the last session here for this particular issue, but I take the health, well-being, and welfare of the future generation and children of Minnesota, as everybody else does here in this committee, very, very seriously. And I think we should consider every source of funding that we have available. And so my question is, would Campfire Minnesota and other organizations like it be able to receive funding from those SGO tax credits that are offered to Minnesotans?
Chair Uakim.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'll bring us back to the bill in just a second, but to answer that question, scholarship granting organizations that would be listed would get to choose where that money went. And just because 10%, 90% of our population goes to public schools doesn't mean that those SGOs would direct 90% of those funds to our public schools. Those funds, because our public schools don't accept scholarships. They don't, can't. They don't make people pay to go to public school. While there may be some scholarshiping that's done for after-school programming within our public schools, that would all be up to these SGOs that would have very little oversight. So, but back to this program, this is a way for us to look at community organizations that we work with that help our kids after school. And like I said, I'd love to expand it and talk about it to have it also be for kids during the school hours. And this is just one bucket we can look at. This is just the beginning of the discussion. I want to make sure that we're also very cognizant of our organizations that have had direct appropriations that may want to be part of the process of figuring out what this framework looks like. So would love to get back to the bill.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the underlying intent here, the purpose of trying to provide services to students to touch grass, as it were, in DePell fashion,
yes.
100%. I think we're all on board with that. The issue with the bill as drafted is the how we get there, right? So it's an interesting pivot to SGOs, but I think the underlying observation there is that, you know, we have a blank appropriation in this bill. We don't know where the money's going to come from or how much. And you juxtapose that against a provision where there's money on the table. It's available. We know it's there. We don't know if this money is here. And the other issue that I have with it is that even taken on its own terms, that this is a problem that's been ongoing for a while. It's going to continue to be a problem moving forward. This would be a one-time appropriation, one-time spending, one-time grants. Mm-hmm. It doesn't provide that sort of ongoing mechanism for these types of services to continue. So I really do think it's the how we get there as opposed to the what we're trying to do that's the real issue here. But thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you. Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Uakim, for bringing this up. This has been a conversation for several years in regards to the mental health, and even with the direct impacts that our youth have been seeing around their own communities, and how do you detach to be able to, so to say, have the soles of your feet feel the dirt in the ground and the lakes that we have that connects us and the river life. And, you know, my little girl, we have our media time where she has access to the amazing programming of TPT, Public Broadcast Station, of having Alma's Way and connecting the games. But it's still not the same of having your hands on blocks and Legos and the connections of being able to fuel your mental health in general. And so, you know, these are the opportunities where we can connect what is technical advantage when it comes to the screens and put a line, so to say, of what is not healthy. And our kids want to be able to play on a playground. I mean, folks have been learning virtually again, and the first thing that you ask kids coming back to a classroom from the COVID pandemic or to even Operation Metro Surge in my school district has been that the kids want to be able to pick up the magazines and pick up the books in their libraries and also be able to play on their playgrounds and be able to do jump rope and soccer with their friends. So these are the opportunities where kids who may not have the advantages of, generational wealth that is surrounding and the variety of different districts that we represent, to have an opportunity to connect with those privileges that we don't really have much of in our school districts right now in the metro area. So thank you so much for bringing this bill. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to go to Rep. Ingen and then Chair Joachim to close out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Joachim. My question for you is grant O&M. Are there going to be costs associated with grant oversight and management from MDE should this bill pass with money appropriated?
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ingen, for the question. So there is a statute that passed back in 23 or 24 regarding that there's an underlying appropriation that's held back from the grant, the money we put in, 5% if it's a legislatively directed appropriated grant, and 10% if it's competitive. I fooled around with the idea of lowering that percentage to MDE, but left it as is because we were laying it over on the table because I wanted this to be the start of the discussion, especially with what Representative Hudson said. How do we get there? How do we figure out how to make this a stable force and ongoing? But no, that's already in statute, and we didn't touch that statute.
A follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. I am a part of this generation. You know, my brother is still a high school student. He's experienced a lot of the mental health concerns that have been brought up by your testifiers, as well as shared in some of the member testimony on this bill. The last thing I want to see is even a single cent of that going towards an agency that has seen over $10.6 million in grant oversight and management costs in the past 3 years. And if we're going to be denying them the resources that we just heard that they need, all for a grant oversight, that seems like it's a misplaced priorities to me. So should this bill go forward, I'd love to see those changes made. Thank you.
Chair Joachim, would you like to close out your bill?
Thank you for your time and attention, members, and your comments and your thoughts. Our students and those who care for them have been very clear about the need for more mental health support in our schools and outside of our schools. This bill, like I said, is just the start of the discussion on what we want a competitive grant to organizations that work with our students to look like. And as we move forward, I would love input from any of you and any of our community partners as well. And with that, members, the motion would be to lay House File 4198 over for further discussion.
Thank you. And with that, the chair lays over House File 4198 for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. And I'll hand the gavel back to Chair Joachim.
This is what happens when you have the chair and the vice chair who also both have bum knees. It takes a little bit for transition. With that, members, I would like to bring up Representative Hill for House File 3930. Welcome to your own committee, Representative Hill. Would you like to move your bill before us?
That would be the motion, Chair.
To lay over for further discussion. And with that, why don't you go ahead and start your presentation.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Chair Joachim and members. Today I'm bringing forward House File 3930. It's a bill that seeks to make progress in the area of teacher retention. My history with this issue has spanned my entire career, and I first heard about the need to support teacher retention during my undergraduate years. It was 30 years ago, and we're still wrestling with this problem today. I was told repeatedly by professors that if I could make it through the first 5 years of a teaching career, then I was likely to stick around for the long haul. And I can remember a professor openly telling our class that 30 to 50% of us would not reach that five-year mark. Again, that was 30 years ago. It's an issue we're still facing today. Today here in Minnesota, more than one in three new educators leave the teaching profession in their first 5 years. Today here in Minnesota, one in three licensed Minnesota educators are choosing not to teach. Today, 70% of Minnesota school districts report having at least one teacher position vacant. Teacher retention isn't just about keeping experience and expertise in our classroom and in our classrooms working with our students. It's also an economic issue as well. The turnover of one teacher position can have costs of up to $20,000 associated with it. One challenge surrounding this issue is recruiting students into the profession, but retention of those who get started in teaching is what this bill is all about. Today, I'm joined up front here with, by Nathan Eklund and Aaron Rabb from Vital Network, here to share more about their successful work addressing this matter over, particularly in North Dakota. So I'd like to turn it over to them for their testimony.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Eklund. I am the founder of Vital Network.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Apologies for my voice this morning. I have a second grader, which means I get all of the germs in the house, but I'm at the end of it, so it shouldn't be still. But my name is Dr. Aaron Rabb, and I'm the Chief Strategy and Impact Officer at Vital Network.
Go ahead and start your presentation.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Aaron. So, and thank you for the introduction, which really, I think, did a fantastic job of sort of showing the scope of the challenge of teacher retention. Currently in the United States of America, teacher retention and teacher burnout is highest in education, self-reported rates of burnout professionally. And we know that that is only an increasing number as more educators actually are considering leaving the profession sooner than they had originally planned. But we also know, and from a message of hope and of practice, that when educators are engaged in the decision-making, communication, and sort of management of their daily experience, that they are more likely to stay. I myself am a longtime Minnesota educator who has spent the last 20 years of my career focused entirely on creating schools that are indeed great places to work. I would encourage you tonight to go home and Google what are the best schools to work in Minnesota, or find best places to work in Minnesota and see how many schools are cited. And so I think really this is a promising conversation around how we organize our school districts around being viable and valuable places to teach and to lead. So from Vital's perspective, we really focus all of our energies not so much on addressing necessarily that there is a shortage, but rather that we can shore up the retention crisis that we continually face by addressing the daily working conditions in our schools. So we have a dual mission, really, from our approach. And one is indeed to work directly with building principals, teacher leadership teams, school cabinets, school boards, and surrounding communities to really make these workplaces exceptional. But we do that with the broader ambition of elevating the whole of the profession. What happens to the teaching profession when we really think about schools as workplaces, when we really think about the conditions in which our adults are working every day? So let's briefly kind of look at Minnesota specifically as per the introduction.
Great. Thanks, Nate. Okay. Somebody's going to have to give me a sign if you can't hear me or understand me. I'm just going to pass it over to Nate. Okay. I'll just bring this up. This is from Learning Policy Institute. This is not our data. This is from national data. Looking across the U.S., we're actually in the third quintile for teaching attractiveness nationally. Nearby states, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Nebraska, all are doing better in terms of the teaching profession, teaching attractiveness. I will say we work, you'll hear more about this in a moment, we work across the state of North Dakota. I know for a fact that they are coming over here and recruiting in Minnesota for our educators to bring them there. And when we think about educators as workers and schools and workplaces, I come from a whole family of educators, long line of educators. I've been in education for 20 years. We don't talk about schools this way, right? We talk about schools as places of learning, which they are. And teachers go to work every day, and they have colleagues, and they have a boss, and they have a workplace. 52% of Minnesota educators say that that school climate, especially leadership support, drives their exit. 66% of teachers who left the profession say that work-life balance is better in their new job, and 58% of teachers who left said their workload was more manageable. It turns out that when teachers come into the profession, and we, I just want to say for the record, we believe in paying teachers well, we believe teachers should be paid well. It turns out that oftentimes when they come into the job, the reason they leave is not always the pay. The reason they leave is the conditions of their workplace. in Minnesota, and thank you, Representative, for mentioning this already. We have about 20,840 six positions that are open. That's about 15% of all positions. 7 in 10 districts report vacancies. And yet we have 38,000 teachers who are licensed, fully licensed, tier 3 and 4, who just aren't working anymore. They're not teaching anymore. They've left the profession entirely. So we have more people, more teachers not working in Minnesota who are licensed than we have open positions. And this is costing us as a state. So it costs learning. Every time you have a teacher turnover, we lose about a half a year of student learning. It costs up to $20,000 per teacher, and this is HR costs and onboarding, offboarding, getting someone up to date, never mind if the position's actually open for a month or two in the classroom. And that's looking at $90 to $190 million annually to Minnesota just in turnover costs. We've spent a lot of money on recruiting teachers. We think this is really important. This is very, very important to be recruiting new people into the profession. We've spent about $200 million in the last couple years on that, but the return on investment, if you are losing a third to half of your teachers in the first 5 years, is going to be very low. And I'll just add, we have a number of initiatives we really want to be successful in Minnesota, the READ Act, et cetera. If you are going to spend a lot of money training teachers and then you lose a third to a half of them, you're losing that return on investment. We've got to keep our teachers there if we want these initiatives to work.
The good news, I think, to share is that this is possible.
I get all the bad news.
Yes. Okay. Well, you know, we can redivide next time. We know that retention really can be substantially driven by improvements to the working conditions in our schools. And so when we think about not just satisfaction, the mental health, the well-being of our educators, but actually executing their jobs, how it is that the schools are organized, how the schools are equipping educators, has a profound impact on retention rates and the length of tenure of our staff. We focus primarily in our work on the mechanics of schoolwork, which really looks at things like time management, how educator voice is informing and at the center of how schools operate. And we look also at levels of care and support that are both systematized inside of the schools, as well as how we forge stronger connections between our communities and our districts. And so to stay on the good news train for a minute, currently working statewide in the state of North Dakota through appropriated funds through their legislature. We are working with nearly 50% of the educators in that state and are starting to see the very gains that we are eager to have Minnesota experience as well. This is a lot to take in on this, but Dr. Rao, I'm going to let you summarize it, and you get to share the good news on this one.
No. Well, the good news is there, but I've also been told that we need to be very brief, that folks are tired, that you want to go home. So I am going to say that all the data is here. The big takeaway here is that this is improving what we are seeing in our first kind of cohort statewide. We've been doing this work for a long time, but really getting to work across the whole region is looking very, very good. You can see the percentage changes. We'd be happy to answer any questions about this. But importantly, we work across both urban and rural settings, which is also very important in Minnesota, that we are seeing these changes. And in fact, rural schools saw just slightly higher percentage increases than our urban. Slightly. We are doing well in both places, but that it's really working in both.
Lastly, I would just like to note that the approach I think that is most powerful in this work is that it's really a matter of integrating with existing systems, programs, associations, and organizing principles within the contexts in which we work. And so we are wholly focused on working with both at the regional levels as well as statewide levels, and also sharing data actively at statewide to inform policy, to inform how it is that we manage and partner with our school districts. And so we are here to speak on behalf of an investment at a state level in terms of how it is that we can work with the Department of Education and other associations to really leverage the entirety of the profession. Together in this work, we are just we are we're bulldogs, that we can that the vitality and retention are possible when we do the hard work of making work work. And so we are here to support this bill and would be eager to answer any and all of your questions.
Thank you. I think I'm going to have you. We have one more testifier. I'll have one of you step aside and then be around for questions, and I'll call up our next testifier, Dr. Justin Killian. Once you get settled, go ahead and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hill, thank you. My name is Dr. Justin Killian, and I'm a policy researcher with Education Minnesota. On behalf of the more than 80,000 licensed and unlicensed educators that make up our membership, I'm here to speak in favor of anything that works on teacher retention, something we've been talking about for more than a decade. I want to thank Representative Hill for bringing this forward because it's a new approach. As the previous speakers have talked about, retention sometimes gets ignored. The members of Education Minnesota want to thank all of you at the legislature for the investments you've made in pathway programs, apprenticeships, grow your own programs. You've done some really great stuff with higher education financial relief. But these programs are putting water into the bucket, and if you'll remember the slide from my colleague's slideshow, that bucket is full of holes, and that water keeps pouring out of that bucket. And so we have to do something to start plugging those holes. This bill starts to correct the fact that 36% of professional licensed teachers in Minnesota, again, that's 38,601 people, have left the job of teaching to move on to some other profession. Education Minnesota studies recruitment and retention on an ongoing basis. And our most recent data collection of our members was probably one of the most sad data sets I've ever had to sit through and analyze as a researcher. And so I want to share some direct quotes from my members with all of you. Quote, I am leaving the profession. I have never been so stressed in my life as I am right now. The anxiety that envelops my chest daily as I enter my building is overwhelming. That teacher's colleague said, yeah, I can echo that. Simply put, things are not good. We are not well. Another told me, quote, I've been sworn at, screamed at, accused of not teaching or doing my job, and I've been threatened. When you have nothing left to give, you cannot continue to fight. I do not have that fight any longer. I'm a shell of a person that I was 2 years ago. Many talk to me about divorce. Many talk to me about weight gain. And for the first time in my role at Education Minnesota, I had not one, not two, but six talk to me about the fact that they think about suicide on a weekly basis. Our members told us loud and clear that it was lack of workplace supports, no supports for student mental health, and demanding workloads that were leading to them leaving the profession because of health concerns, because of what's falling apart at home. And they were very loud and clear that the toxic positivity that is used to try and stop this isn't working. In fact, I had a member tell me if one more person walks into my classroom with a Snickers bar and tells me to smile and remember my why, I'm going to lose it. The last thing I'd like to leave you with is a statistic, and I fact-checked myself this morning because I use this statistic a lot. It's still true. According to the National Institute of Health, which professions have the highest urinary tract infections? The number one is long-haul truckers. But do you know who comes in a really close second and third place? Teachers and nurses. We're not even giving these people the time to go to the bathroom during their day, and we're asking why they're fleeing this profession. So we thank Representative Hill for bringing this effort forward to start correcting some of this. We have to give attention to the well-being of our teachers, because if they're not well, we're never going to do better for the mental health of our students. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. Representative Hill, you have
thank
a comment,
you.
And then
thank
we'll
you
go to member questions.
To the testifiers, and just in closing, I wanted to bring this bill forward because the Vital Network was the first entity that could demonstrate with data that they have effective ways to address this issue. And I really want to thank them for their presentation and their work and begin the conversation here at the Capitol to talk about this as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, and I have Liz started. I'll go to Vice Chair Clardy first.
Thanks for bringing this bill forward. So as you know, I recently retired after 30 years, and this conversation was going on back then, and it's not gotten any better. But if we always start with having the kids in the center, all our decisions are really easy. Mm-hmm. So I just made a couple notes on things that this bill does. You're investing in kids and students. You're creating stronger relationships. Student achievement is going up. Higher quality of instruction. And like you had talked about, like the reading instruction for Reading Core. And school stability, which is what we want. And that leads into the community, too. So you have a stable school, you have a stable community. So thanks for bringing this important bill forward. I fully support it.
Thank you, Vice Chair Clardy. Representative Kwan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm hearing, we heard from one testifier a lot of the negatives, but there are some school districts that actually teachers are moving to after they've been teaching for a while. And frankly, we should start focusing on, we got districts where we don't have these problems. The teachers are happy. They're going from one district to this district or that. You need to look at the positives and help you see success and then cross-pollinate that instead of, I hear a lot of focusing on the negatives. Well, the negatives, you got to realize, but we have districts that are working. Districts that are very successful for their students, and let us learn and cross-pollinate what works to the other districts. That's just my input to the people.
Representative Hill, any? Or if that, if saw you nod your head, did you want to say anything, or should I move to the next? Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
You wanted to say something? Go ahead. Just briefly, though.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Representative Kwan, for that. And it is one of the kind of core design elements of how we work, actually, is connecting our districts with one another to think about how do we learn across and share our lessons across. So, this is working for us and our educators in this district. Oh, I didn't even know you could I didn't even think that you could structure your time that way, or we could move to an early out in this way, or we could restructure our PLC in this way. And I think you're exactly right that a big part of it is looking at those, we call them green spots, right? There are bright spots in a state and in a region, and how do small districts learn from other small districts and larger districts? I absolutely agree that a big part of it is looking and learning, and that's the network part of how do we kind of share across the network to make sure we raise up everyone rather than having everyone trying to go to three districts.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is one of those scenarios where the dots are almost connecting for me, but they're not there. Okay. And it's probably just because of my lack of familiarity with the specific work that you guys have done and how it interacts and interplays with more external factors that I think have really contributed to the type of burnout that you're talking about, right? So when we first started hearing the presentation, kind of leaning back skeptically thinking to myself, well, how does this address the issue of your retirement being subpar or your pay being subpar or the bureaucracy that you have to deal with, the reports you have to write, all the things that are imposed on time and bandwidth that might be the root causes of why people are feeling the way they're feeling about the direction of the profession. Issues like school discipline. What do you have to endure? What do you have to tolerate from the student body? My instinct is to say, I don't know how this addresses any of that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, from what I've been able to glean and, we've been sitting here researching and what have you, it sounds like there's a parallel issue where there are some cultural things that you can do to make life easier that are separate from the policy issues. Am I understanding that correctly?
Who would like to answer that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that question. It's a great one. I will note, and it's probably warrants a longer answer, but I will just say that inside of your question actually are some principles of how it is that we would look at working directly with schools, for example, well-being and burnout and salary and healthcare benefits and external factors are all profound impacts on educators. So is having your fifth reading curriculum in 3 years that no one asked your opinion about, for example. So is attending a PD where you was misaligned with actually your job description, for example. So the work of that engage with directly at school levels and at district levels is really in the like sort of the minutia of how we manage schools. So how do we have viable teacher leadership teams in each building that helps to inform district and building level decision making? How do we communicate effectively between administration and educators and district admin? So really building internal capacity around the workplace. And so I'm just gonna keep using workplace as sort of a new lens of addressing an old problem, and that is really thinking about the value that our employees bring to their own work and lived experience. So while we cannot ameliorate some of those external factors entirely, managing those factors in a more collaborative, thoughtful, and structured manner certainly lessens the deleterious effects of those external factors.
Thank you.
Representative Paris Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Hill, for bringing this. I love having conversations with educators, with teachers in my school district and in other school districts outside of where I represent. And when you think about the realities of what we've faced since the pandemic and all those tier three teachers coming back and wanting to go into tier four, and they're saying it's because it's a support system. Mm-hmm. And that has been through a village of educators communicating via Zoom, and now in their lunches when they have 15 minutes, if they even get 15 minutes to breathe. And so, like, for me, this is just amplifying a call for action for those educators that are sticking through and want to mentor more folks into the field by keeping it real, right? And I appreciate the testifiers who came to talk about the realities and the data, the research, how this not only is a way to be able to support those educators that have stuck around for over 5 years, right? But also an opportunity to say, we are the coaches for the next generation of what is going to be the advancement of, yes, the workforce, right? But a good overall healthy Minnesotan. Mm. And those children, our children of Minnesota, our students of Minnesota deserve that. And how you get it is by making sure that our educators are getting what they want. And it's bare minimum of requests of saying, this is what we need. It's taken a village to get us through this. Can our state now help get us through this in what we're facing presently? And so I appreciate you, because that's been amplified by so many of the educators that I have been speaking with, not just in my district, but throughout this entire state. And they are very thankful for you to bring this bill up too as well. Gracias.
Thank you, Representative Paris Vega. Representative Green.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thank you, Representative Hill, for bringing this this forward. I just signed on to the bill. Sitting here, so I just so am grateful for the focus and attention on this. I come from a family, I have a lot of teachers in my family. We are a district where we don't, in my school district, you know, we have pretty high teacher retention, and they are still telling me all of these things. So, and I appreciate, like, the shared, you know,
pollination.
Pollination, thank you. I couldn't remember the word. The pollination word that Representative Quam used. No, I appreciate that, and I think that is true and something that we need to do. But I do think this is such a major issue. And I think we as legislators down here need to make sure when we're passing legislation that we are thinking about this all the time and through the lens of teachers. I don't know any teacher that goes into education for the money, and I don't know any teacher who goes into it not to try and make a difference in the lives of kids. that is consistent across the board, across our whole country. And so I just, I really appreciate this. I think we need to get out of the way a little bit too and make sure that when we're passing stuff here, that we are truly thinking about the whole system and making sure the students are at the center, because I think that will help as well. So I'm very much in support and grateful that you brought this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Green. With that, I don't see any further questions from the table. Representative Hill, would you like to wrap up your bill?
Yeah, I wanted to point out briefly that I'm honored to be a teacher. It's my dream job, and there are challenges associated with the profession. And nothing hurts worse than losing a colleague who is really good at what they did in that setting. And you know, I just want to offer that. You know, I've had people without a snicker come to me and what was that movie Dory? Tell me to just keep swimming when things are tough or there's challenges. I've been blessed with really good building leaders and really hardworking and focused school board members in the district where I've been for most of my career. But it's not that way everywhere. And, you know, my first teaching job was in an adjacent school district, and it was a very different climate, just 10 miles up the road. And so if there's a way on a scalable effort that we can begin to have this conversation and talk about this, I think it's going to meet the needs of our students better, and it's going to make our education system stronger. So thank you for the opportunity to get the conversation going.
Thank you, Representative Hill. With that, Representative Hill renews his motion that House File 3930 be laid over for further discussion. Do we have Representative Hill? Perfect. Thank you. I'm excited about this bill, so that's what I was just making sure. So Representative Keeler is here for House File 3585, and I believe Representative Bakeberg was going to join you as well. And Representative Bakeberg, would you like to move House File 3585 before committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. And with that, I don't see, did we see an amendment? There's an A2 amendment. Would you like to move that before the committee? Move
it. Yeah, yeah, so moved, Madam Chair. I can't hear. So.
Oh, that's okay. I should move
forward. You can't walk either. Did you see me?
Representative Keeler, would you like to just briefly describe the amendment?
Sure. So the amendment is adjusting. So when we had this bill up in education policy, we had students from the Minnesota Youth Council attend. I love when our youth attends and gives feedback. And one of the things that they asked is there was some language in there that said one student from the Minnesota Youth Council would be listed to this. We made an adjustment to make sure that there's one student from the 7-county metro and one student from greater Minnesota. That's what the amendment is.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Perfect amendment. With that, members, anybody have any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The A2 amendment has been adopted. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, co-chairs and members. We've been talking about attendance for a while. Thank you, Representative Bakeberg, for joining me in this conversation. One thing that we have done from the very beginning is we have really tried to address attendance from a bipartisan way. It has been from the very beginning. Representative Lawrence was also on the task force. Representative Bernig, I don't know if she's in here. Oh, right there. Hi. You guys do seating weird in here, but it's fine. And so we were all part of a legislative working group that really talked to the state border-to-border different groups on, like, where are we when it comes to attendance. We've spent a lot of time talking about literacy. We all agree that it doesn't matter how much we spend on literacy. If students aren't in school, they're never going to learn how to read. I've shared this a couple times, but when I got my master's degree in educational leadership, my practicum question was, what were the barriers to academic success outside of academic rigor? And it was proven to us that there are just a lot of holistic outside things that are going on with our kids. They're hungry, they don't have housing, access to mental health. And so we dug into this a little bit more, and from that task force, we came up with 8 buckets of importance when it comes to our kids and what they need. And Representative Bakeberg and I really worked hard on making sure that we were inclusive in this list. And so it included things like just definitions of attendance. A lot of you, if you've ever talked to your schools, even the difference between what your elementary marks as attendance to what your high school marks as attendance is very different within your own district, let alone as a statewide. So we're really trying to work on shoring up that. Also the coordination between our state and local agencies. There's a lot of overlap. School is a requirement in the state of Minnesota. There's also an element of family preservation. So if children are missing school, it gets sent to the counties. So it's really important that we had good lines of communication. There were a lot of conversations about community engagement and how our students can really be a part of the community while earning credit. We see this a lot in smaller communities, particularly where maybe we have shortages in daycares that are short on staff or senior living assisted locations are short on staff, that maybe they could be utilizing some of our high school students in those spaces. And so we've talked about that. We really sent out some specifics for the department because we do believe that the department could lean in with some specific recommendations as well. There was a data sharing component into this. And so, like, as I mentioned before, when schools have to partner with counties, they're sharing a lot of information. It's important that we know how data is being shared. There was also a conversation around having specific staff within our counties, within our schools, to specifically address attendance. And last, the transportation need. We all know that, like, getting kids to school and home is really a big part of this conversation. And so that's a lot of buckets. That's a lot of things to talk about. It's not overly exciting to a lot of people. I understand that. And so where we've landed is it's just too big of a thing for Representative Bakeberg and I to continue to take on ourselves. There's been some other areas within work in Minnesota that we have started what we call interagency councils, particularly like the Interagency Council to Address Homelessness, Harm Reduction, or Public Health. And so there's interagency councils, there's subcommissions or subcabinets, there's different ways that we can set things up. So this is just an attempt to try to get creative at making sure that our agencies take down those silos. They often work so much within their just one realm of work that they forget that it's their job to like work alongside the other agencies on a goal. And so that's what this bill does. We know that there's still some work to be done. We'll hear probably some from testifiers who want to be added to this list. I caution us to continue to just add more people. We've learned that when you just add more people to what looks like a task force, it gets very hard to get good work done. The goal of this is to put the agencies in a space together so the agencies can do their work and oversight to address attendance collectively. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to hand it over to Representative Bakeberg.
Representative Bakeberg.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think Representative Keeler hit the nail on the head walking through the different buckets, and just would like to thank Representative Lawrence and Representative Vernig for their work on the task force that we had. And, you know, one of the to really boil it down, the goal of this bill is to get the agencies talking to each other, because as we move through that task force process and we move through just last year's session, that was one of the glaring pieces that frankly needed to happen more often, were people just talking to each other about what are they doing and how does this bill or this idea, how does that interact over here? And, you know, just in my normal role, thinking about it from a principal lens, I don't look at it from a lens from a child protection standpoint. But if I have a really strong relationship with our county partners, we can have conversations and then I can learn from them and vice versa. So in Scott County, we've tried to work really hard about breaking down some of those silos. So the intent of this, and Representative Keeler talked about, we still have some work to do, but the intent is to break down the silos between the different agencies so that late in session, we're not getting a call and saying, hey, can we sit down and have a conversation? And we as lawmakers are like, well, where did this come from? You know, we're at the end of session. We're right before deadline. We've got to get some things moving. So to break down some barriers, get people talking, get people working together, and really solving problems. Because at a very basic level, and Representative Keeler said it well, if a kid's not sitting in math class, they're not going to learn math. And I think that's one of the things I've appreciated about our partnership through this, is she looks at it through one lens. I look at it through another lens. But we've learned from each other, and at the end of the day, kids are in a better place because of our learning. And that's what we'd like to see the agencies do, to be very blunt.
Thank you. With that, Representative Keeler, would you like to go to the testifiers?
Yes, please.
Yes, so next we have Matt Shaver and then Patrice Velaford on deck. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair Joachim, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver. I'm the Senior Policy Director at Ed Allies. We are education advocates for kids. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support of House File 3585. This bill is multi-years in the making and has influence from the attendance study group that Representative Vernig and Representative Lawrence served on. Relates to the work that Chair Joachim has fostered through the statewide attendance pilot. It also relates to work that Representative Mueller, Representative Sensenmaier, and Representative Green have supported as well over the years. This bill is also a result of Chairs Bennett, Jordan, Cresha, and Joachim placing their trust in the two legislators up here next to me, and as an example of the best of what Team House can do. Many hands working across different perspectives and geographies, breaking down silos to tackle a complex issue. Kind of like what an interagency council would do. See what I did there? Ed Allies has three arguments to make on chronic absenteeism today. This is a statewide issue that significantly impacts each member of this committee's community. Solving for chronic absences is complex work because it's an issue measured in schools with root causes with solutions not always, but often outside the reach of schools. And an interagency council is a smart and innovative approach to holistically addressing an issue. The most recent year we have statewide data on chronic absenteeism is not for this year or last school year. It's for 2023-2024. In that year, one in four Minnesota students were chronically absent, essentially the same rate as the previous school year. That year, there were 191,321 chronically absent students statewide who missed at least 3 million combined days of school. At 165 days, Minnesota already has one of the shortest school years by days of any state in the country, and we have too many kids missing too many of those precious opportunities to learn to read, do math, make friends, find their purpose and passions. We have amazing teachers, administrators, and programs every corner of the state. If you look at our statewide data and the local data on your cheat sheets, too many kids who benefit the most from what school has to offer are missing the most amount of time right now. Your data shows it also hasn't always been this way. Tinkering around the edges or inaction means this post-pandemic data becomes the new normal, and we refuse to let the dust settle. Next, I'd encourage you to look at a recent study done by MDE and DCYF on kindergarten absenteeism in Minnesota. They talked to professionals who work directly with families of kindergartners across the state to better understand barriers to attendance and identified five major themes: health issues, socioeconomic challenges, family obligations and crises, ambivalence about kindergarten, and transportation barriers. It's an interesting study, and think about how barriers and solutions may look different at the middle and high school level or in different regions of our state. But I also ask us to consider which of those barriers elementary schools are legitimately best positioned to address and move the needle with families on. We'd argue schools can probably make the most impact, not ought to be expected to be most responsible for addressing ambivalence around kindergarten and transportation to an extent. The rest of the barriers cited in that study are affecting a metric we hold our schools accountable for, and yet the levers of change impacting those systems are mostly outside of the control and wheelhouse of teachers and principals. Now, those systems do exist. Efforts and initiatives to improve access to housing and healthcare and transit are happening in Minnesota, but the connective tissue between them is weak and lacking a unifying purpose. That's where the Interagency Council on Attendance comes in, to orient and coordinate those efforts as anti-absenteeism work. Too much good work is happening in silos, which is causing kids and families to fall between the cracks. The promise of an interagency council is those systems can work together to address root causes, prevent attendance issues, provide a more cohesive response as they arise. Transportation policy is attendance policy. Housing policy is attendance policy. Economic policy is attendance policy. We need an interagency council on attendance to get key representatives from these fields alongside students as outlined in the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to show our support for the bill. Thank you, Rep. Keeler, for carrying it. Thank you all for your public service to our state.
Thank you. We have Patrice Velaford from the Minneapolis Foundation, and then Megan Ariola on deck, and then three more after that. So if people can keep their comments a little tight, that would be wonderful. Go ahead and get settled and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee. My name is Patrice Velaford, and I'm the Vice President of the Minneapolis Foundation. I'm here to express our strong support for House File 3585, the Interagency Council on Student Attendance. The Minneapolis Foundation is one of the oldest community foundations in the nation. Our mission is to drive collective action to realize strong, vibrant communities. We cultivate generosity at the foundation by taking action on the greatest civic,
social, and economic needs in our state and the region. Over the last few years, we have deepened our support and convenings around chronic absenteeism, working with many of the stakeholders mentioned in this bill and the two wonderful people to my left. Some of you may know that we fund the Minnesota Principal Survey, which is administered by the University of Minnesota Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement. In the latest round of the survey, which closed in November of 2025, principals across the state named chronic absenteeism as one of the top issues and challenges that they're facing as educators. I also want to thank the previous testifiers because student mental health was also cited as a top challenge by our principals. And this is a survey that's done with principals statewide, and it has a strong response rate in Greater Minnesota and in the Twin Cities. And they came to this, people come to this survey and they bring their work and they bring the challenges to them that they're facing in their work when they respond to the survey. And I want to point out that chronic absenteeism was cited as a top challenge before Operation Metro Surge. And as many of you know, that operation worsened the crisis. The reason absenteeism is so difficult to address is that many of the causes lie outside of the factors that the school has control over. Scholar Sarah Linhoff and Jeremy Singer from Detroit captured this well in a book called Rethinking Chronic Absenteeism, Why Schools Can't Do It Alone. They spent several years researching the issue of chronic absenteeism in Detroit, and their research shows that absenteeism is a multidisciplinary ecological issue. It's shaped by many factors, such as housing insecurity, transportation gaps, public safety concerns, and other community issues. The takeaway from their research, which is reflected in this bill, is that, again, schools can't solve this alone, and that they recommend that policymakers, such as yourself, consider cross-sector coordination and action to support schools, families, and communities. That's why our foundation supports this bill, and we believe that every smart policy, every wise investment in education that we make depends on one simple fact. It only matters if our students are there to take the benefit from it. I want to thank Representative Keeler for her hard work in carrying this bill, and I also want to thank Representatives Keeler and Bakeberg for their enduring commitment to address chronic absenteeism. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. I appreciate it. I appreciate this opportunity. And from the Minneapolis Foundation, again, we are strongly in support of this interagency council because, again, it reflects the research on this issue.
Thank you for being here with us today. Megan Areola and then Kalik Rogers on deck. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you again regarding House File 3585. For the record, my name is Megan Areola. I serve as the Legislative Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Education. I, like the past two testifiers, will begin by thanking Representatives Bakeberg and Keeler for their strong commitment to improving Minnesota's statewide response to student attendance. Their sustained engagement with the department has helped build a solid foundation for the collaborative work being envisioned in this bill and for the success of this student interagency council on student attendance. I am happy to share that much of the work outlined in this bill is already underway at MDE, and we appreciate the structure provided here to support that work long term. The responsibilities will be largely taken under the wing of our Compass team, staff with expertise that are already engaged daily in supporting districts, coordinating resources, helping schools address attendance challenges, and beginning some of those cross-pollination networks that Representative Quam mentioned. The Compass team's work ensures that schools have a clear state point of contact for direct support, that agency staff with the right skills are leading coordination across systems, and that they have a person they can talk to. To carry out the responsibilities in this bill effectively, it is important to be clear that the
work and the long-term planning underway at MDE is currently being done by four Compass staff whose positions are funded with dollars set to expire at the end of the next fiscal year. If those roles lapse, the state's ability to deliver the timely, consistent, and accountable support that we want to give our districts will be significantly limited. But I do appreciate the interagency collaboration here. Another testifier before me said it best, that nobody does this work alone, and we look forward to beginning some more fruitful partnerships with our other branches of the executive branch. I want to close by just reaffirming MDE's commitment that every student attends school consistently, every student feels welcomed and safe, and has access to caring, qualified educators. Our schools and our communities deserve dependable state partners who can help keep our students connected and engaged and valued. And thank you for considering our testimony. I will be available for any questions.
Thank you. Kalik Rogers up next, and Zuriel Bastul on deck, and then Lawrence, a student that's here. So go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Kalik Rogers, the Executive Director of Catalyst for Systems Change. I want to thank you, Rep. Bakeberg and Keeler, for introducing this important bill about chronic absenteeism. And just frankly, just wanted to start off just saying, like, this is a very, very important issue. And for many reasons that have already been stated. One thing I want to make clear is that the goal is to not be in opposition of the bill, but it is to say that this is needed, but it also needs to have proper representation when it comes to lived experience. When we talk about chronic absenteeism for the communities that are affected by absenteeism the most, are often left outside of those conversations. We tend to be utilized not proactively, but reactively, as a last thought, rather than being part of the co-creation of the decisions and design that are being made for these said communities. And without having proper representation from communities that are experiencing these issues themselves, we create solutions that are well-intended, but are short-sighted. And our goal is to make long-term, sustainable solutions that are also co-designed by the people who experience the problems, but are also implemented by them as well, because they will be the ones that sustain these solutions, that help build the culture around the solutions created. And it's very, very important that they are also included amongst the list of young people who are being afforded this opportunity. For those that are the least amongst us, because not all those students are represented at the Minnesota Youth Council. And we're in partnership with Minnesota Youth Council as well. We just want to share that, and I'll rest my case for the young person to speak for themselves. So thank you.
Thank you. I have Zuriel Bastul and then Lawrence. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Zuriel Bastul. I am the program coordinator for the Minnesota Youth Council, and I'm here today to express my support for House File 3585 and to thank you for adopting the amendment to change the membership language in line 2.6 to 2.8 of this bill. Chronic absenteeism looks very different in cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul than it does in cities like Painesville and Moorhead. Barriers such as transportation, school climate, and work and caregiving responsibilities look very different based on where a student lives. A 2015 study published by Springer Nature titled Association Between Neighborhoods and Educational Achievement found that students' educational outcomes are significantly impacted by neighborhood characteristics. Having only one Minnesota Youth Council member risks centering only one type of experience that may not be reflective of Minnesota's youth and thus may not meet all of their needs. Requiring both a Metro and Greater Minnesota member ensures that rural, suburban, and urban youth perspectives are at the table when solutions are being designed. When those solutions to chronic absenteeism are informed directly by the students that they affect, they are more likely to be relevant, culturally responsive, and sustainable long-term. Our youth are experts in their own lives. They see firsthand how policies land in their classrooms and their hallways, and that is in a way that data cannot capture, nor we as adults can understand from the outside looking in. by guaranteeing two Minnesota Youth Council seats, one in and one outside the metro, you're not just inviting youth to have a seat at the table. You are building youth leadership and geographic equity into this council's work from day one. I strongly urge you to advance House File 3585 so that the statewide strategy on attendance is not just built for students, but with students. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we have a student testifier who can come to the table. And you can either say just your first name, we allow students to do that, or your full name, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Lawrence Wells, and I'm a student at Paladin Career and Technological High School and a member of the organization Catalyst for Systems Change. I'm here today to ask you to include more diverse student representation on the committee for House File 3585. If this council truly wants to attack the problem of chronic absenteeism, you need to hear directly from students like me and others who have personally suffered through it. During middle school, I suffered from chronic absenteeism. And for what I thought at the time was very good reasons, and I see now, really weren't. But whether it was my family life was really hard at the time, my middle school kind of let me down in multiple ways, and I also let my middle school down in the way of being absent. But that doesn't change that perspective that I have matters, and it also matters for all the other students that have it too. The Minnesota Youth Council is full of students with great academic success, achievement, and attendance records. And that is great and amazing to have in this committee, but it is also very limiting to only have them. If you want real solutions, I feel you need to hear from students like me and others all across Minnesota. Students from programs like PSEO and MapStars, students from organizations like Catalyst for Systems Change, students from alternative schools and charter schools. I think that this bill is truly amazing, but the ideas that I propose right now will elevate it to a higher level. That is all.
Thank you so much for being with us here today. With that, members, I'll move to questions from the table and discussion. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, and thank you, Representative Bakeberg and Representative Keeler, for bringing this bill forward. I had a couple of questions, and I actually really appreciated hearing from the student who talked about the need for more diversity. I do feel like every student who has an issue with chronic absenteeism needs to be looked at differently, and I do feel like there's so many different factors that go into not attending school. I think mental health is one of the big factors, and I'm wondering if there's representation on the council for someone who can understand student mental health needs. And then my other concern, too, is that parents who really are the ones who are trying their best to get their kids to school, I'd like to see them represented on this council, too. And then lastly, I think about, like, today is Mental Health Day on the Hill. I've talked to a number of people today. There was one of my constituents, she works for Relate Consulting or Relate Counseling. And she talked about how, you know, students are not able to meet with counselors. There's not enough counselors in the schools. Minnesota is ranked number 48 in terms of student-to-counselor ratio. So I do feel like we need to really look at the mental health needs of our students and have that kind of representation on this council. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
Representative Keeler.
Thanks. That's what we did in the work group. That was the work that we did. I want to reiterate, this is an interagency council. It's designed for our state agencies, and then we have listed a couple of the partners that agencies work with as far as like counties and specifics. When we start to add like nonprofit groups or other groups, which I agree, then it looks more like a working group or a task force. And so we have to remember, like, there's only three entities in the state that are set up around our agencies working together. To list all of those people and to add people, we have to remember, too, that that creates a different cost component. But when we add, like, multiple people from the communities, it, and we lean more into what a working group or a task force would look like, which we did. We've spent 2 years on a working group. All of those people who you've named came to us right? I mean, I don't think we missed any of those, came to us and really shared what we need to do, which is why we landed here with the interagency council. I'm with you. If youth want to come and build a youth subcommittee or subgroup, I think that's a really great idea. It's just not what this bill is intended to do. So the big picture idea, I understand. I completely agree. More people to the table. It's why I love and encourage our youth to come and testify so that you're hearing from them in every decision that we make. I just want to make sure that we're staying within the scope of what our goal is to really bring our agencies together to do this work in a cost-effective way. We know that we're working with a very small budget here, and so that's also why the language is pretty tight around that. Not to disrespect the excitement that people want to be part of this, but that's just want to reiterate that that's where we are in this bill specifically. Bakeberg, did you want to add anything?
Bakeberg?
Yeah, I would just echo what Representative Keeler said. We had fantastic representation through our working group and through the task force. And Representative Ream, much of the groups that you talked about, they either were a part of the task force or came, and we had specific feedback from those different groups. And then that's how the task force came up with the eight different buckets that Representative Keeler talked about.
Great, thank you. No, I really appreciate that approach. With that, we've got two more people on the list because we want to make sure we get in under time here. But I have Representative Green and then Representative Clardy. Unless Representative Lawrence, are you trying to get my attention? I'm sorry. Are you sure? Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thank you so much, Representative Keeler and Representative Bakeberg, for bringing this. I just wanted to compliment the work that has gone into this. I think what the heart of this bill to me does is it just creates a established priority across the agencies. This has to be a priority, and that collaboration has to be a priority. And so all the work, and I love all the voices in bringing them in, and now it feels like we need to take all of that and then move in the same direction. And so I really appreciate this bill. I'm in support of it. I think it will move the needle, which is the goal. And so I just really appreciate you guys bringing it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Flaherty.
I guess I wanted to start out by saying, ditto, I really appreciate the work and the efficacy of it. I'm just wondering, could you speak a little bit about some of the matrix that you've put in there to kind of measure the effectiveness of the work that you're doing?
Representative Keeler.
I think, so the one thing that's not in here that we talked about in policy, it's hard to say when this should end or like when we've hit success, because the idea would be that we hit success when 100% of our kids and 100% of our districts are going to school all the time. Like that's just, those of us who love education would love that more than anything. That's just maybe not the reality. And so that's one of the pieces that we've chatted about is, do we name a sunset day? The thing I think we've landed on that we're still working on with the information that Shaver gave all of you guys, this, I think you guys all got this sheet. There's some data that shows like where we were in Minnesota pre-pandemic, our average was around like that 87%. And so we really talked about like, would we end said interagency council once we got back to those pre-pandemic rates? Is there another percent that we would want to hit? But I think too, in the establishment, the idea would be that the first step of this would be just establishing the interagency council, having like an individual, and this is how like some of the other sub-cabinets and interagency council started, is then they come back to you guys next year in a budget year with sort of a plan on how they would implement some of that and the wrap-up of it. But I think we have taken the approach that a percentage of attendance across the state would most likely be the end parameter of the success or dissolve of this interagency council.
Right. That's
open for a lot of discussion. Because I think there's no way that we could just set a date for it to end. I think we have to look at a different parameter.
Thank you. And then with that, I think I'll let Representative Keeler and Bakeberg wrap up however you'd like.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you. Thank you to Representative Keeler. And even just going back to Representative Clardy's question and what Representative Green talked about is really making sure that this is an established priority. Getting kids to school is a priority. And you know, having an end date is difficult because the needs are going to be very different. So having this be an established priority from this legislature moving forward is something that I would hope we continue to do. Representative Keeler and I won't be here
moving forward. So I guess we'll pass the baton on to some other people. But I would just say, thank you. Thank you to Representative Keeler. Thank you to the committee. And we look forward to continuing to work to support our kids.
Representative Keeler.
Yeah, same. Thanks, Representative Bakeberg. I think we did this in a really unique way. We started bipartisan from the very beginning. And I hope that maybe what that can do is also show an example of how we can do what is right for kids and not let politics get in the way of it. We have had to go very slow because it's important for all of the stakeholders to really be seen and listened in this process. If it was up to me, we would be much further down the road and have a lot of things implemented. But I think that this is a prime example of what we can do when we come together, not only across the aisle, but also with community and alongside our parents and families across the board. And so, again, attendance is the number one issue in education in the nation, and our kids cannot read and they cannot do math if they're not there. And taking an approach like this just makes it a priority. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your indulgence, and we hope that we support this effort.
Thank you. Chair Krishna, did you have any comments? Or okay. With that, we'll renew the motion that House File 3585 be laid as amended, be laid over for further discussion. With that, members, we have a break coming up, so it'll be a little bit before we see each other, but I want to check with Chair Krishna if he had any updates for the first Tuesday that we're back.
I believe we're just going to be looking at special ed and talking a little bit about the Blue Ribbon Commission.
Sounds good. With that, members, we are adjourned.